If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Coming up on Heard on the Street, why Trump's tough new immigration rules could mean higher food prices, and which company might be the next takeover target in the race to build self-driving cars.
Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Hello and welcome to Heard on the Street, the podcast. We are the Wall Street Journal's home for commentary on all things financial all over the world. Reporting from New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried, joined by my colleague Alex Frangos in London. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Miriam.
So in our second segment, we'll talk about Intel's deal for Mobileye and which companies could do the next big deal around self-driving cars. But first, we have Heard on the Street's Justin Lehart here in the studio to talk to us about the impact President Trump's tough new immigration rules may have on food costs. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
So Donald Trump and other anti-immigration advocates have really pushed the idea that curbing illegal immigration will benefit average Americans in part by helping them get jobs. But you looked at sort of the flip side of that argument in your piece this week, which is what would happen to prices for food? Why are food prices so intertwined with immigration rules?
Yeah, there are just so many undocumented and documented workers, also immigrants, who work in the fields, migrant workers, and also some people that, you know, stay put working on dairy farms and the like. And, you know, if you take those folks out of the workforce, then, you know, somebody needs to fill that labor hole. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do. And in the meantime, we could see food prices climb a lot.
How do we know? How are we able to know kind of the degree to which food prices would climb if there were a labor shortage?
It's hard to know exactly how much. But one of the things that I looked at was what happened in Georgia in 2011. So Georgia passed a strict immigration rules in 2011. It really it cast a chill for the immigrant community. There was a lot of it was just fear. There were rumors that there were going to be checks at the Florida-Georgia line and that kind of thing. And a lot of migrant work crews simply bypassed the state that year. And then what happened was, you know, farmers had a real pinch for labor. And a lot of them actually just let crops go unpicked.
Isn't the natural reaction to this if there's not enough labor to mechanize where things aren't mechanized? Or is agriculture, you know, is that all done? Is there nothing left to mechanize?
Yeah, there could always be something left to mechanize. You know, in some of these crops are, you know, they haven't figured out how to do it yet. Picking blackberries, knowing which tomato, knowing that a tomato is ripe or needs to be left on the vine for another couple of days. I mean, those are things that, you know, machines don't know how to do. So, you can't mechanize on a dime, right? You know, the other thing to do is say, well, you know, maybe if you just pay higher wages, right?
Yeah, raises maybe you could get some of the unemployed workers from other parts of America to come and work in your farm.
Right, and that's always sort of that's another answer, right? There has to be some price at which people will pick blackberries above what the farmers are offering now. And again, if you let that happen, then food prices go up. Now, what happened specifically in Georgia is, you know, people didn't come in. They didn't raise wages enough to be able to do it. And part of it is, you know, there is a skill to picking crops. It's not something that you know, you or I could just go and do well. And if you talk to farmers, too, they say, listen, we pay pretty good wages, you know, for people who know how to pick. You know, there's people can argue about that, but they also say, you know, I asked one guy in Georgia, is like, so, you know, how many blackberries would I pick in an hour compared to one of these workers? And he's like, half as much. Right. And
I
probably wouldn't come back the next day because I would hurt so much.
So, Justin, if prices go up for U.S. farmers, does that mean good things for farmers in Mexico, for example? Will we be importing a lot more crops because they're cheaper?
That would be one thing that could happen, right, is that we could fill that hole with imported crops. That seems to go against President Trump's sort of ideas as well. So it's hard to see how that exactly would work. That wouldn't play very well politically. We cut down on illegal immigration, and now we're importing a lot more from Mexico. I can't see that flying so well.
It's interesting. I mean, they're having this very similar debate here in the UK, where I'm in London, and they're, you know, going through Brexit, and the big kind of subtext to that is immigration. And one of the things that is being discussed is allowing migrant workers to come to pick crops so that they don't have this exact problem of, you know, food inflation caused by lack of workers. So, you know, there's a long history of the Bracero program in the United States of, you know, Mexicans coming in legally to pick crops and then go back. I mean, do you think that's going to be a solution, or is that something that Trump is not going to allow?
Well, that's something. So one thing that happened in Georgia and also Alabama, I should mention, passed a law the same year. It hit a little bit later, closer to, you know, passed a lot of sort of the labor intensive crop time. But a lot of farmers there did move to this H-2A visa program, which allows immigrant workers to come. Now, H-2A, if you talk to farmers, is not sort of the be-all and end-all sort of solution for them. You have to do a lot of stuff to get these workers. And, you know, sometimes it's really, you know, there's some things that you have to do that are pretty hard. For example, you have to offer housing for these workers. So you need to, in some cases, you need to build housing. You may live in a rural county that has never had any zoning for this type of housing. So you're going to have to go to the zoning board and say...
So these are all costs, in other words, that are going to end up on your plate.
These are all costs that are going to... And the costs may simply be, you know, too high. And there is also this other problem. There is just this, you know, if people are worried, then they're just not going to come even on one of these programs. They're going to be scared of doing it. It's going to be a real interesting harvest year.
So what does this mean for the, I mean, I just think as an investor, I mean, there's, you know, when you think about inflation and how this would feed into the Federal Reserve's thinking, I mean, they often will see through a temporary spike in, you know, in food prices or energy prices. But, you know, how much does food make up of the CPI basket? And, you know, how, you know, is this something that's going to, you know, tip the scales for Janet Yellen to, you know, increase rates down the road?
They would tend to look through this because it would be a even if it was persistent, it would be a one-time push up in prices. I mean, I think the thing that you do have to think about as an investor, though, is, look, if I'm paying a lot, if as a consumer, I'm spending a lot more for food, right, then I'm not going to be spending as much on other stuff. And also I have to think, well, you know, if I'm looking at, you know, a company that sells food, right, what is this going to do to their margins, right?
Yeah, I mean, the restaurant business will be hurt on both sides, right, because you've got a lot of immigrants working in the kitchen in many restaurants, they may not be the publicly traded restaurants, but that does affect the market for labor supply. And then on the other side, you have the food prices. The raw materials that restaurants are buying. So that could be a squeeze.
And the fact that people are just eating at home more anyway because they want to.
We are going to have to take a break. Coming up, self-driving cars. Who will be the buyers and sellers in the push to be there first?
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Hi, this is Paul Gigot, host of the Potomac Watch podcast. Join me and my colleagues every week as we dissect all of the latest happenings in Washington. Check us out at wsj.com/podcasts and become a subscriber on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and the Google Play Music app.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Welcome back to Heard on the Street, the podcast. I'm Miriam Gottfried here with Alex Frangos and Dan Gallagher, who joins me in our studio today because he is visiting from San Francisco. Hi, Dan.
Great week to be here.
I know. We really welcomed you with some wonderful weather.
Yeah.
So, Dan, earlier this week, Intel agreed to buy Mobileye, which is an Israeli company that focuses on self-driving car technology. It paid $15.3 billion, or as you pointed out, 63 times forward earnings. That is a lot. Do you think future self-driving car takeouts will command similar premiums?
I think they'll command premiums for sure. I don't know if they'll all hit that particular number, but this is a, I mean, all the pieces are in place to get good deals here because it's you know, definitely going to be a big market going forward, but it's still years out, I think, until we get to, you know, something that's really mass market. So the car makers are right now trying to get the technology in place. A lot of the technology they don't have in-house. So tech companies are building up to it, building into partnerships with car makers. So there's all. So I think there's a lot of there's a setting here for a strong M&A bid. That said, Mobileye, I think, was kind of a unique asset in the fact that they had sort of a completed technology along with all these partnerships with car makers that fit really well with what Intel was trying to do. The companies were already in partnerships. So it made a lot of sense for Intel to go after it. And valuation-wise, it was actually cheaper than Mobileye has been historically.
Sorry, Dan. Sure. I just had a question about Mobileye. Is Mobileye a chip company or a camera company? That's the thing that I had trouble understanding.
Well, they're kind of both. The edge in their technology is really in the chips and the software, the cameras. But it's a camera system that they develop, you know, but there's not it's not so much about the lens and the physical part of the camera. It's what the technology allows the camera to do, which is read cars. So it's I hope that makes it clear.
Are there other companies like Mobileye sitting out there waiting to be acquired?
I don't think quite as neat as them, where they have, you know, an existing solution really built for this market and the partnerships in place. There are a lot of there are chip companies like NVIDIA, which competed with Mobileye in a lot. NVIDIA didn't necessarily do a camera-based system, but they're building – they're using their graphics processors to build, you know, like essentially turnkey solutions to put into cars for self-driving cars. Their market value now is above $60 billion. I don't think anybody really comes in to get them.
That would be a big bite even for like a Samsung or a Microsoft.
That'd be huge. That'd be a big bite for Apple, which has been interested in cars. I honestly don't see them as so much a target, but as a potential buyer now that they have a fair amount of cash, they also have a very valuable stock. It's more than doubled in the last year. And they've not done a lot of M&A historically, so I think that would be an interesting one to watch because they too want to continue pushing into this car space. So if they found the right things to fit in, I definitely think they'd go after it.
My question on self-driving cars is it feels a little bit to me like this is the first round where everyone gets excited, pays way too much money for things. Then there's going to be like a clear out because the technology isn't ready yet. And then, you know, 10 years from now or 15 years from now is when, you know, they're actually going to be on the road and we're going to figure out who the winners are and who's actually made the money. Does that ring true to you, Dan, or do you think it's closer at hand?
Well, I think it's a little closer at hand. And I also don't think the biggest issue, I mean, I think the technology is getting close to being worked out now. I think what's going to make self-driving cars, you know, kind of a years out process is all the other things that have to happen for these cars to really get on the road en masse. The regulatory changes, insurance, cultural. I mean, we're in America, especially out in California where I am, we're in love with our cars. We're used to driving our cars. There's a lot of things, I think, to get over before we have fleets and fleets of self-driving cars on the road that don't really have anything. I think the technology will get solved before those things get solved. So I think the technology will move ahead.
Did you think Intel maybe bought too soon, or is this just they just had to do it?
No, I don't think they bought too soon because if you're trying to get in, I mean, the car makers design years out. So you don't try to get into a car design next year the way you might with the iPhone or something. You know, these designs, I mean, Mobileye has business booked into 2019 and beyond just on driver assistance technology. So that's kind of the lead in these car makers have. So if you want to be a player in self-driving cars past the 2020 timeframe, now is a time that you have to really have the relationships and be getting into the design process right now.
Dan, what about the big car makers here in the U.S. or, you know, abroad? what role do they play, and do they have to go out and buy some of these self-driving car technology companies?
They may try. I mean, I'm sure they're sitting there thinking, okay, we want to, I mean, they don't want all the value to accrue to Silicon Valley companies for sure. But they also have to realize, okay, what can we do? What's our core competency, as opposed to especially chip companies like Intel and NVIDIA, where, you know, a self-driving car, if the technology is going to work, it's got to have a lot of powerful onboard computing to do that. And that's stuff that you don't just start 1 year and have. So that's why they're getting into partnerships with these companies. But I think the car makers and the auto parts suppliers are definitely looking at what can we buy to stay competitive.
And can they pay 63 times earnings? Probably not. I mean, that might be a barrier for them to really get into this business, right?
That'll be a big barrier because, you know, for tech companies, cars are a big potential end market that they haven't had a lot of before, especially when you're looking at a company like Intel. It's historically made its money on PCs, which is not a growing market, and servers, which kind of has some is a decent market, but it has its own challenges. You know, cars are, you know, if you think of the amount of chips that'll be per car in the future, a very major growth market. So if you're going to compete, and Google's interested in this too, for an automaker, it has to make them shudder. I mean, General Motors has about 20-something billion in cash. Google has 80 billion. It's going to be hard for, I think, if a tech company wants to compete in M&A against, you know, an auto parts supplier or an auto company, tech company's probably going to win out just on the financial power alone. But that depends on if they're going after the same type of companies. And, you know, that won't happen in every deal.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on why Silicon Valley may increasingly be squeezing out car companies.
News on the go. Whenever you want it, wherever you want it. WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
So, Dan, to me it seems really interesting. You know, like my dad has this all-electric smart car, which is not a self-driving car, obviously, but the entire value of the car is in the battery. And so I think this connects to our conversation that we were having, which is just, you know, where is the value in the car? And if it is increasingly going toward these pieces that these Silicon Valley companies are creating, you know, that could mean bad things for car companies. So, I mean, from a stock perspective, how would you play this movement?
Well, I don't spend a lot of time looking at car companies to know all their various merits. So I don't know if I'm qualified to say I would never buy a car company kind of thing. And I think the technology is really important. So the battery tech in an electric car, the chips and the processors in a self-driving car, but that's not the entire equation. So if you're going to have cars that are going to be like an electric car, to make it really efficient, has to be light in weight, but you still have to have strength in materials. So there's a lot of innovation outside of what tech companies can deliver, you know, in the polymers and all the design elements still. So it's not all based in one facet of the car. And I think car makers who've been in this business a very long time and kind of know the design process still have a lot of value they can bring. So I got a feeling what we're going to see is a lot of partnerships going forward, rather than saying there's going to be one company that wins it all. And I think that's why we've seen, and some of the partnerships get really confusing because there's a high number of them. You're a car company and an auto parts company and a tech company and a specialty tech company are teaming up to do this and that. I think that's because you need to have all those competencies in place to get like something really compelling on the road.
We are going to have to end it there. That wraps things up for this week's Heard on the Street podcast. Please join us every week for the latest in global investing. For more, please check us out at wsj.com/heard. That's wsj.com/heard. You can also email us with your comments, suggestions, or questions at heardpodcast@wsj.com. From New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried. On behalf of the rest of the Heard on the Street team, thanks for listening.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.